This is Pep Phelan here from the Poach podcast. And I have with me today Dominic Guerrera, who is an Aboriginal Education Support Officer with a health service in South Australia. Hi, Dominic. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. So tell us a little bit about yourself before we get on with the rest of the chat.
Hey, so a little bit about myself. I'm a Ngurrindjeri and Kaurna person, and I've been working in Aboriginal health for 17 years. And like you said, currently employed as a education support worker in the Aboriginal Health Council here, where we deliver the certificate 3 and 4 in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander primary healthcare. And yeah, I also am a poet and a farmer and a podcaster. I've got a lot of hats on.
You do. And you and I met, even though I knew of you from Twitter, you and I met at the Lowitja conference up in Darwin was it June 2019? It was around that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
You were there with a group of researchers presenting a wonderful and incredible piece of research. Can you tell us about that report that you were presenting?
Yeah, so it's the Aboriginal Gender Study, and it was the project that Lowitja funded. We worked on the gender report where we went in to 3 communities and we spoke to Aboriginal people about contemporary understandings of gender and gender constructs. A labor-intensive research project with a really short deadline. It was something that not only opened my eyes to the power of research, but also to the power of our people and the resilience and strength that lies within the communities, but also how stuff like that is even gendered. Yeah, so it's a great report to be a part of.
Can you, in really short terms, briefly tell me about what came out of that report around Aboriginal identity and gender? It's a great report, and I've obviously looked at it from my research perspective. It'd be great to hear what the brief outcomes were from that particular report.
Some of the findings, because we conducted 3 kind of separate yarning circles. Well, we conducted multiple yarning circles, but in 3 spheres. And one was with Aboriginal women, one was with Aboriginal men, and the other one was with Aboriginal LGBT people. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that particularly the roles and responsibilities part of it was, how do I put this? That first of all, the Aboriginal gender roles and responsibilities were very different of a Western construct. That Aboriginal gender roles were constructed around culture and responsibilities, but within a community, so not within an individual, which is no surprise to us. But that there was also the impact that colonization had on communities and had on gendered roles. And then also the interaction with the wider, you know, white community or non-Aboriginal community, and how Aboriginal people were perceived within their genders and the legitimacy of their genders as well. But what we did find was that there was a lot of responsibility of holding the kind of the community together was done by the Aboriginal women. And for Aboriginal men, there was a sense or urgency for, you know, male gendered healing to take place. Mm-hmm. And for men to take up their responsibilities again within the community, even though there are men doing those responsibilities, but that women are going through or have gone through it, their healing process. And then, you know, it's an ongoing thing, but there's a lot of men who are not going through that. And the other thing for the LGBT community, Aboriginal LGBTQ community, was that, you know, they're facing not only just the racism, they're facing the homophobia. The thing that I thought was the most beautiful was, despite some people experiencing homophobia and transphobia and investing as being excluded from culture or excluded or isolated from community, they still were connected to culture and community. They just found another way to do so. And I thought that was really beautiful, because it, no matter who is policing your access to community or culture, there's a way around them, or you will find a way around them, or that you are still connected no matter what. And that particularly Aboriginal women who identified as lesbian or bisexual still took on mothering roles within the community. So like being aunties, if they weren't mothers themselves, but also being, you know, caregivers to nieces and nephews, and especially those that were of their sisters' children. And I just thought that was really beautiful. Like there was people before us doing research in this area, Aboriginal people. We're just a part of a chain of adding to more knowledge, and, you know, hopefully more and more Aboriginal people do research around gender and contribute to what we contributed to as well.
So are you still doing research? Are you still involved in research at the moment?
After that, I had to take some time off because it was like, it was intense. Like research, I didn't realize how in my head the research project got. You know, you have to sit with this data, you have to sit with these stories, analyze them and think on them, and it's a process that you have to go through. And that's why I understand why when people were finished they want to go and just stack shelves, or they want to go on a holiday and work or something, because the process of sitting in research is a heavy thing. So I took some time off. I went back to kind of my old work, which was work, health, workforce education stuff. I started up some fun projects. I got back into poetry. I got started podcasting, and then gone back to my master's this year. I'm in re-enrolled and I'm feeling very geared up to kind of go back into the academic space.
You've kind of gone the opposite way. You've done the research during your master's or before you've completed your master's.
Yeah.
Realize the intensity of the research process, taking time off. And then you've come to a period of time in your life where you're just like, okay, I need to go back and complete this master's. I think you're doing a master's of gender studies, is it?
Yeah, so it's a master of arts, and it's actually still called women's studies because the school hasn't progressed to gender studies. I don't know if they will. I think it's a historical reason why they keep it as women's studies, and that's, you know, fair enough. But I want to study gender studies. There's not many gender studies masters here in Adelaide, and I want to study, you know, close to home. I am kind of using the vehicle of gender studies for what is my future aims, which is to work in and around art and art curation, and to make sure that these themes of gender are present in that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a very short simmered down though. Yeah, I mean, like, I've always been interested in gender studies, and that just happens to be where I'm studying, at Flinders University. So
talking of art, last year you curated a really important exhibition. Would you like to tell me about that and how you think it relates to Aboriginal health, social and emotional well-being, and all those other things? Why was it so important to put that together?
Well, I actually saw this as an extension of the Aboriginal gender study report, the research I worked on. Even though they weren't connected, it was an extension. And I was really fortunate that Ali Baker, Dr. Ali Baker, who's an amazing Aboriginal academic at Flinders, was approached by a small gallery here in Adelaide called Nexus Gallery to curate an exhibition. Well, they asked Ali who would be good and called my name. They reached out to me, and I was also very lucky to get access to the collection of the Flinders University Museum of Art, their collection of Aboriginal paintings. So my suggestion I put forward to Nexus was to do an exhibition that explored Aboriginal gender roles or gender constructs through the artwork that had already been created. And because I feel like they're on white gaze, particularly a white feminist gaze over Aboriginal artwork, or Aboriginal artwork gets critiqued or viewed through that white gaze. And if we look at gender, then it's through a white feminist gaze. And, you know, I believe that we have our own gender constructs, as every probably nation or group does, or it's contextualized to the culture of those groups. And I wanted people to come into the room, particularly Aboriginal people. I did the exhibition for Aboriginal people to come into the room and have gender at the forefront of their mind. when looking at these images and paintings and photographs, and they weren't particularly gendered photographs. They weren't like, a lot of the stuff wasn't like women's stuff or men's stuff, or, you know, it was the storytelling of Aboriginal people's lives. But because we had said this is a, you know, the theme of this exhibition, which was called Circles to Us, was gender. We put the Aboriginal gender lens on it. People walked into that with that on, I was hoping people would walk in with that on the forefront of their mind. And I hope it inspires people to, when they're looking at Aboriginal artwork, to think about Aboriginal gender roles that may be present in artwork and how it's constructed within our communities, as opposed to thinking about kind of cookie cutting us into white constructs of gender and gender binaries as well. And that also goes for Aboriginal queerness as well. Like all queerness around the world, it's contextualized to the communities or the cultures that people exist in or identify within. And I think it's very easy to just whitewash queerness. And I definitely am not a white queer. I'm an Aboriginal queer. And I wanted to have a bit of that represented. And so it was hard because the challenge was the Fuma collection. I couldn't go outside of that. I had to make sure that the work, that I had artist permission. But then I was also fortunate, I won a grant and I was able to pay three Aboriginal artists to write pieces in response to the exhibition. And two of those writers were queer. So there wasn't a lot of queer Aboriginal art or artists present in as much as I wanted to be. But that also doesn't matter because it's queer Aboriginal people step into that space. They're looking at this and connecting with this artwork as well. You know, the artwork is speaking back just as much as we are speaking to it. That's why it was important to have two Aboriginal queer writers to show that living dialogue between the artwork and the Aboriginal community. And we had Latoya Rawl and Sasha Smith, and they wrote really beautiful pieces. Latoya spoke about death in custody. Sasha spoke about being a Bolandic woman, the destruction of her land, showing Aboriginal queer people are embedded in the communities they exist in. The third writer was Corey Theatre, who's a singer-songwriter who's also doing his research in linguistics, his PhD. And he wrote a poem in what I call linguistics poetry. I don't know if he's invented this new form of poetry. Yeah, he wrote in a very linguistic style of how they write out words and then and translating it to English. And yeah, just was phenomenal work. It was a challenge as well because of COVID. So we got it up online in South Australia. We were very cool, go visit the gallery. So it also, it went online and it also became something that people could visit physically. It became really successful. We had like over 1,000 people visit the exhibition online, and it was only running for I think 5 to 6 weeks in its completion. And yeah, so I'm doing another exhibition with them at the end of this year. I think the theme will definitely be around Aboriginal queerness. So I'm going to hone in and really think about it, but I want to change the shape of the space. And I want to think about poetry and think about touching or like feeling things with our hands and stuff. I don't know. I've got to work with the artist around that stuff. So it's in very early days.
It sounds exciting. So you'll have to keep me up to date with that so I can let people know.
Definitely, I will. I will. And hopefully we'll be vaccinated. People can come over for it.
The other really interesting thing you've done, which was absolutely fantastic, was the ASH podcast. And, yeah, you know, it was really very successful. There was, you know, quite a few people that were really engaged with it. Can you tell me about the ASH podcast and why you started it and what the outcomes were and what you were hoping to achieve?
Yeah, so I used to work in a white family planning service here in South Australia before I come back to work in the community controlled sector. And I really struggled. It felt like a daily fight having to put Aboriginal perspectives and experiences into the sexual health space, because it's, to be honest, it's very much dominated by white nurses who are women. And I understand that because it was a space that they, it was a bit of a women's movement, a bit of a one, there was a huge one, but it was a movement that kind of centered white women. And working in that space, it was like really hard and challenging to always like bring in the Aboriginal perspective. And before that, I had worked at an Aboriginal community controlled org. I'd worked at Tour. So I never had to be questioned. I never had to argue the point of why we did things for Aboriginal people a particular way. So when I left that org, I always wanted to create a space for Aboriginal people to just be able to speak about sexual health without the shame, without the stigma, and with humor, and not also it just be always educational. So it couldn't be conversational, that these are the conversations we're having as Aboriginal people around sexual health. So I first started out recording interviews with Aboriginal people, and then I didn't like it because I wanted it to be kind of a show as opposed to just talking. And I reached out to Sasha Smith on the request of a friend. And Sasha is, like I said before, a Bowendick woman who's also a very out and proud sex worker. And so I was like, it's perfect. You know, like here I am in the health sector, here's Sasha in the sex industry sector. And together we're going to bring, you know, a lot of information and conversations. Yeah, we ran for just a few months shy of 2 years. We did, I think, about 3 live shows all up, and one of them was for Melbourne Writers Week. We had a really great listening base. I don't like the word fans. And we ended up joining an Aboriginal network called Awesome Black, which I recommend you all to go be a part of. And we just wanted to have for it to be fun. I've had Aboriginal people come up to me and saying like, oh, you know, I used to listen to your podcast and it was hilarious. You guys made me laugh about this. And like that, that's when I knew that we were achieving what we wanted to achieve. And unfortunately, because it was a hobby project, it always came second to our extremely busy schedules. Like Sasha has been involved in language building and community building back home in Mount Gambier. I'm, you know, always doing health and worked full-time at the time in health and was trying to start a farm and doing poetry. And we just kept not having the time to record. And so we decided to end it. So we ended up on a high, I feel like. And the best thing is, I really hope that, you know, within the next 2 or 3 years, there are 3 Aboriginal podcasts that incorporate sexual health or focus entirely on it. And that they're different voices, and that, you know, maybe they're younger people, maybe they're older people, but that encourages Aboriginal people to talk about sexual health and talk about gender and sexuality, and it not be shameful, taboo, but also respecting cultural boundaries. That's the other thing. When we really look at the stats for sexual health, you know, they're just as bad as any other part of health, but yet it always gets pushed to the side for diabetes and heart and rheumatic heart, all the important issues, but you know, sexual health deserves its seat at the table as well. Yeah, I just hope that it helped contribute to a growing dialogue amongst Aboriginal people. And also most importantly, I hope that it helped Aboriginal sex workers feel seen and respected within the community. You know, maybe educated some people who might have been anti-sex worker or dismissive, you know, not supportive of family who are sex workers. I hope it impacted that space as well.
It's interesting that you spoke about the sexual health space, particularly is organized and run by nursing. So if I can sort of paraphrase what you'd said. And nursing is based very much on this sort of medical model.
Yeah.
And within a medical model, everything is, you know, reductionist. People's entirety of their health is reduced to fractions of their health. How do we embed a more social model in the sexual health space, do you think? Because obviously the holistic model, the social model, follows the much more holistic model of Indigenous health. So that needs to be embedded in order for there to be cultural safety in that space.
Absolutely. And I think that because I come from my background really is in health promotion and harm minimization. And the only way that they're successful in it, including social health as well, is that it has to have community involvement. It has to be contextualized to the local community, because that is where the cultural barriers are. That's where the social determinants are. And they're going to be very different community to the next. how condoms are distributed in a community is going to be, should be dictated by the community or informed by the community. So needs to be more money to, there needs to be more community, Aboriginal community control needs to have more a cut of the pie of resources and more autonomy on what to do with those resources within community. I think large scale health promotion is not working. It needs to be localized. And yeah, just putting things back in the hands of local, refunding health promotion at a smaller scale. You know, as someone who does health promotion, who has a postgraduate diploma in Indigenous health promotion, I know that the most successful health promotion is localized, and that it's and should sit within the community controlled sector. I'm also really concerned with sexual health also just being focused on STIs and not being looked at more broadly, including contraception, because contraception is not being spoken about in the way that it should be. It's very much like, go to your doctor, get the prescription, and off you go. And it should be a dialogue with the health workers within gendered cultural safety. So women talking to women. Yeah, contraception should be more of a dialogue that should be taking place. And also, you know, gender, sexuality needs to be brought into this. I personally think one of the biggest areas that we fail, two of the biggest areas that we fail to address is sexual assault and rape. We don't speak about it enough. And we need to be confronting this head on. We need to be, without demonizing, without broad stroking or generalizing what's going on, but actually speaking to the truth. You know, talking to young men, that early conversation with young people, but not forgetting that there is a gender, so it does this generation, and, you know, we're going to get it right from now on. We also need to be addressing the people who are not young, who are, you know, out in being and addressing that, because I don't believe that people are too old to learn. So we need to, yeah, we need to address rape and sexual assault. We need to address violence against women, gender-based violence. You know, we need to address homophobia and transphobia. I'm going on a tangent. My other big thing is looking at sex as pleasure. Forget it. We often just talk about sex from a deficit point of view. We talk about it as disease focus, but we should also be talking about it. And there are people who are doing all these things, by the way. We need more of it. And talking about pleasure is central to people owning their sexuality, their gender identity, their sexuality. And therefore, I think less ashamed of who we are. And that's a big thing in our communities is shame job and shaming people who are in touch with their sexuality and proud of it. You know, the talking about pleasure when it comes to sexual health, as opposed to just looking at the diseases that are attached to it or the infections, is that I personally think the first and only step to leading us into a holistic way of looking at sex. Because people are out having sex because it is pleasurable. That's already established, but we don't bring that into the health space. And yet when we talk about exercise, people are always like running because that's fun. If you enjoy the social element of that, blah, 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 blah. But yet when it comes to sex, it's like, it's just, it's very shut off, or there's a lot of judgment from the doctors and nurses around their own personal values and beliefs that needs to be left at the door. Spent a lot of time with an auntie of mine who was also working in sexual health with me. And we sat and spoke about shame job. We really wanted to unpack, why is it that we as Aboriginal people are so ashamed? Why are we attached shame to our sexual health? What is it about it? And it's just connected as an outcome of colonization as any other damage that has been done to us. We need to address the impacts of colonization on our sexual identity, our sexual health. And when we think about it, there's been so much, and it's gendered and it's layered and it's internalized. And one of the big things that came out of it was that feeling ashamed about our bodies. Now, being shy is one thing, being private is one thing, but being ashamed of our bodies, it was the dialogue of the colony, or the voice of the colony, or the voice of the colonizers, that they got to leave within us. they got to walk away. They don't need to say this because it was installed in us. You know, it was drummed into us that we should be ashamed of who we are, of our bodies, of our nakedness, of our sex, of us having feeling that we are entitled, not even entitled, but we are allowed to have pleasure in our lives, to be proud of who we are. And that includes our sexual health. We have to learn to unpick that from us and replace that, or allow what was existing there to come to the forefront. And I do believe that that is an act of decolonizing, embracing our sexuality, embracing our gender roles, embracing our gender identity, whatever it is, taking control of our sexual health and feeling proud of who we are. That is an act of decolonizing. And there's so many examples of that that's happening. Trans and brother boys and sister girls and non-binary siblings who are just like, really, like, you hear that conversation happening when they're talking about their identity and the process of transitioning or coming to who they are and who they know they are. And decolonizing is in that. And I really love that. And I think that I want to see more of that.
The process, the act of queering and being queer is inherently a decolonizing process, because you have to unlearn what you've been taught, what you've been indoctrinated into.
Yeah. And like, it's, you know, like homophobia and transphobia, there is a huge streak of that within colonizing. You know, like, the colony enacted homophobic and transphobic and misogynistic violence on Aboriginal people. And there are people who are addressing that, and there are people who are bringing that to the forefront. I just think we need more of it. I don't think just being queer doesn't equal decolonizing. I think you still have to do the work of thinking about how the colony has impacted queerness.
Absolutely.
Or impacted queer people, and then do the work to bring that out. Because queerness is not a colonial construct, it can be decolonized.
Absolutely.
But you still have to do the work to get there. And that's what I'm saying, is those individuals are doing work, and I'm seeing it, and it makes me feel really proud of them.
Here's a question for you, and you've already kind of spoken to it. When queer, or however people choose to identify, LGBTIQ, SB+, enter these health spaces, they bring with them a different knowledge, experience, and existentiality that then informs heterosexual people, particularly, of other ways of knowing, being, and doing.
Yeah.
And inherent in that is actually they bring with them the ability to be able to heal that sort of sexuality and gender space because of the experiences they've had, because of the work that they've done. You know, a lot of people haven't done the work, but there's a hell of a lot of people who have done the work to try to understand how their queerness is a colonial process and how to unpack that and to try to remove that from their life. Do you think that queer mob, LGBTIQ, SB+ mob, have a significant role within health spaces, particularly sexual health spaces, of starting and continuing and progressing a healing process?
Yes, because in order for one person to heal, all of us need to be healing. We need to have everyone aware of things, because we are connected as community. We are connected as family and as people. I'm already seeing what you're saying. I'm already seeing queer Aboriginal people at the forefront of health. And it's not to say that queer Aboriginal people haven't experienced homophobia and transphobia as workers and as clients and patients in Aboriginal health spaces, but it seems to be a little bit more of an accepting space than other industries, particularly sexual health. I don't know, there's a bit more leverage to push back on that homophobia and transphobia you might experience. So one thing I'm doing here at the Aboriginal Health Council is I don't spend much time resting. We're currently undertaking the Rainbow Tick. I know there's a few other Aboriginal orgs doing it as well. I think some mob over in Nam are doing it. Peter Wapple Crow, is it? Mr. Peter, I love him. It's more than just going through the process, because it gives us the ability to have the conversation.
Yep.
In the workplace. I created and delivered the workforce training. Bless the people at the Rainbow Tick. They had training, but it just wasn't, I had to contextualize that. I had to make it Aboriginal. I'm hoping now that that training, we're going to take that to all of the Aboriginal community controlled orgs here in South Australia. And, there is a responsibility within the community controlled health services to actually step up. And some of them are doing it, but there needs to be more. And I'll tell you why. And it's because a lot of our mob don't go into community controlled health services, a lot of queer Aboriginal mob, especially the social and emotional services. So they'll go to the clinic, but they won't go into the social and emotional wellbeing services, not all the time. And I'm speaking generally. When someone in my community, in the Aboriginal LGBT community, is feeling suicidal or is homeless, needs to go to the emergency room, the responsibility of caring for that person and advocating for that person, majority of the time falls on other Aboriginal queer people to do that work. And I have spent my weekends and my weeknights and my weekdays even pretending to be a social worker to get someone into housing. I've gone to the deathbeds of Aboriginal people who have committed suicide because of their mental health, Aboriginal LGBT people who have committed suicide. And I kept thinking, I work in health, and where are we talking about this? Where is the presence? It's one thing, and a lot of people, when I have conversations with community here, a lot of people say, well, gay people can come here, trans people can come here. And I said, but do they know that? Have you told them that? Have you, put up signs? And I don't mean like an actual poster. I'm talking like the signs that this is a queer space.
Yeah.
Are you visible in Aboriginal queer spaces?
Yeah.
Are you sponsoring Nungay Night? Are you, as the CEO or the management or the clinic workers, are you attending those events? What presence do you have in the community that we've built?
Yeah.
Because I'm the one that's there in the hospital. I'm the one that's filling out the forms to get people into housing, because we don't want an Aboriginal trans person living on the streets, because we know what that means for them. It's not enough to just say or think people can come here. You need to act it. You need to show it. You need to be actively showing it. The same way that you are actively showing that women are welcome, Aboriginal women are welcome to women's spaces within health clinics, the same way that men are welcome to, or we target men, or we target young people, or we target elderly people or elders. It is the same way that we need to be targeting Aboriginal LGBTIQ plus people, that they are welcomed, and that the service, and the next step is training your staff to make sure the needs of these people. It's a many step process, my other thing is I really do, services want to do that. They want to be a service for all Aboriginal. They want, the majority of the workers want to. Sometimes they just need the guidance on to how to. Mm-hmm. And working at the council, that is my responsibility. I'm a resource to my community, the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Services. So it's my responsibility to push for that and advocate for that. So I'm hoping soon that will happen, that will be rolled out across all communities, the training, the community controlled orgs. But it has to be localized as well, because I've heard that there's going to be some Aboriginal LGBT training. And I just think, really? Like, how do you present what's needed for Perth way up in Cairns way?
Yeah.
It needs to be contextualized. It needs to be and it needs to come from the community. So everything that I've been doing has been informed by a community advisory committee.
Yeah.
I'm sick of this homogenous, nationalized approach. I want localized. I want community involvement. That is true community controlled. That is true health promotion, harm minimization. That needs to be happening more often.
Absolutely. This particular podcast is really about Aboriginal health leadership and, you know, seeing all the stuff that you've done and continue to do. You are out there as a Aboriginal health leader, particularly within the sexualities and gender space, LGBTIQ plus space. And all the information that you've just presented is just so critical and so important. These are conversations that people just aren't having or are not privy to. Like, we're having it. Yeah. I have it. Other, you know, Aboriginal LGBTIQ SB plus people have it. And we have it often, but other people don't. So this has been a really important conversation. And thank you so much for all of your openness, your knowledge around it, and sharing your experiences and the experiences of people within your health service or within your community. It's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. To all the mob out there, you know, stay strong, keep community centered in all your work, and we're making a change. We really are.
Thanks so much for coming in, Dominic. And I look forward to hearing about all the great things that you're doing both this year and in the coming years. Thank you.
Thank you.